Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Earlier this month, Cuba's president Fidel Castro turned 80. He is the world's longest-serving political leader. However, a recent illness and what was billed as a temporary handover of power to his brother, Raúl, led to a wave of speculation about what would happen when Castro was no longer in power. This morning, in this part of the program, we will explore that very question as we talk with Brian Littell, someone who has been a Latin America and Caribbean specialist for the last four decades and does a lot of speaking on these subjects. Currently, he is a senior associate in the Americas program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. He retired in 1998 after 3.5 decades working as a foreign intelligence officer. He served in the U.S. Air Force and for extended periods as Latin American specialist at the Central Intelligence Agency and also the National Intelligence Council. From 1990 until 1994, he was National Intelligence Officer for Latin America. That's the highest-ranking analytic position for that region in the U.S. intelligence community. He is the author of a book that was published last fall in October, a book titled After Fidel, The Inside Story of Castro's Regime and Cuba's Next Leader. This book is published by Palgrave Macmillan and goes into great length to describe Fidel Castro and his brother Raúl Castro and their lives. We'll talk more about this in this hour of Focus 580. And of course, people who are listening are welcome to call in, ask questions. We just ask people, please do be brief so that we can accommodate as many different callers as possible and keep the program moving. But of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Littell, hello.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. You know, I have been looking for, trying to find the most recent articles that I could about Mr. Castro's health and what's going on there in Cuba, and I can't seem to find anything that's more recent than about 2 weeks. Maybe you have better sources. Can you say something about what is the most recent information about, first of all, about his health?
Well, it's a big mystery. The Cuban government is keeping it as a state secret. But yesterday, Raúl Castro met with a visiting Syrian minister, and Raúl Castro went on the record saying that Fidel is making a satisfactory and gradual recuperation. But it's very hard to say. Many observers believe that Fidel is never going to be back fully in charge again, that whatever it is, it's very, very grave.
Mm-hmm. And so it is also the case that to this point, then, the handover of power that was said to be temporary during the time that he was going to be treated and recuperated is still in effect.
Yes, it is. And it's been just a couple of days short of a month now. So, it looks less and less as if Fidel is going to ever be back fully in charge again.
Mm-hmm. I think that for a long time now, the speculation was that were he no longer able to carry out the duties of the presidency, whether that was because he had passed, because he had debilitating illness, because he simply decided to retire, which seemed not likely, but if any of that would happen, that the expectation was that his brother, Raúl, would become the president. And there doesn't seem to be now any reason to have and to doubt today that, in fact, what we for such a long time had thought would happen is what will happen.
Well, exactly. It's been almost a month now. The succession has gone over smoothly. I've heard no reports of demonstrations or riots or any kind of political unrest in Cuba. Raúl, after all, was first designated the successor by Fidel back in January 1959, and his position as first in the line of succession has been ratified repeatedly over the years. It's included in the wording of the Cuban Constitution. And in any event, Raúl has plenty of muscle behind him. He controls the three most powerful institutions in Cuba, the military, the security services, and increasingly he's dominant in the Cuban Communist Party. So, and there's a fourth thing, too. Raúl, through a number of military officers, controls a very large percentage of the Cuban economy through military-run enterprises.
perhaps you could talk a little bit more about Raul Castro. He is not as well known as his brother. He seems to have shied away from the spotlight. He seems to, he's not as charismatic an individual. He's not as powerful a speaker. For a long time seems to have been content to be a bit in the shadows. Now, if he takes over and becomes president, that is going to change. Tell us some things about this less well known of the two brothers.
Well, he's a fascinating character. I did a lot of digging when I was writing after Fidel, and did interviews, found former teachers, priests who had known the Castro brothers, including Raul, relatives who are in exile, defectors who worked very closely with Raul, former friends and associates and military colleagues and other Cuban officials. I conducted a large number of interviews. I also read just about every word that Raul has ever uttered in public. That is not nearly the kind of task that I put to following Fidel Castro's words. Raul does not speak as often. He does not deliver long speeches. But I found that Raul is a very complex individual who has been underestimated now for decades. I think he's been the only truly essential man at Fidel's side since the beginning of the revolutionary process. That goes back to 1953. I argue in After Fidel that Fidel could not have lasted all of these years in power, just almost 48 years, without the assistance of Raul, his brother. And one of the main reasons for that is that Raul has controlled the military on the island with an exquisite organizational sense. Raul is the organizational man. Fidel is anything but organized, but his brother complements him in that sense. So Fidel has charismatic skills. He's a visionary. He communicates very effectively. He churns up great ideas. Many of them never come to pass. But Raul is more plodding. He likes to be in the background, but he's the organizational man in this revolution.
Hmm. How to what extent does the charisma of Fidel Castro and the way that people feel about him, and I think that it is true that there are a lot of Cubans do really have this father of the country sort of feel about him.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent does that help them cope with all of those things about life in Cuba that are uncomfortable, that they would like to change? And if you have a change of government and you have the Raul Castro who doesn't have that kind of charisma, what does that mean for the commitment of your average Cuban to the values of the revolution and the kind of social structure that Cuba has had now all this time?
Well, you know, that's one of the million-dollar questions now. I think as long as Fidel is still alive and, you know, is some kind of presence on the island, Cuban people are waiting with some apprehension. But after Fidel is gone and some period of mourning, some decent interval passes, there could be a certain political awakening that would not happen on Fidel's watch. The government has admitted that 2.5 million younger Cubans born since the Berlin Wall came down, are disaffected. They don't feel an attachment to the revolution. They have not benefited much from the revolution because most of the years since 1989 have been ones of terrible economic hardship. So these 2.5 million younger Cubans are a very large wild card. The regime has said, they've admitted, that they're very worried about that youth cohort. Now, how Raul deals with them is going to be the critical, one of the two or three most critical variables. He's going to have to give them a greater economic stake, I think. He can't rule by circus, revolutionary circus, the way Fidel has for so long. Raul is going to have to give these people bread. He's going to have to give them more material advantages. And therefore, I think he's going to begin reforming, decentralizing the economy, perhaps attracted to the China model, the Vietnam model.
Would a change of power from Fidel to Raul make it easier for the United States to have a more normal kind of relationship with Cuba?
I think that might be in the cards. I think that Raul, my research led me to the conclusion, and I articulated in the last chapter of After Fidel, I concluded that Raul is the practical brother. In fact, that's the very term that Fidel's daughter, Alina Fernandez, shared with me. She said, my uncle Raul is the practical brother. And he is much more inclined, I think, to leave rigid ideological strictures behind, to be less intransigent than Fidel has been, especially with regard to internal economic reform. And once he begins down a path of economic reform, I wonder if he won't want to begin probing the United States, seeking ways to end this 48-year stalemate.
Mm-hmm. And there is in among the Cuban American community, at least a large segment of that, long standing hostility towards Fidel Castro, and a demand that nothing less than a complete change of government is what they would want to see.
Yes,
and that has some people have argued that has made it impossible for the United States to have a more normal kind of relationship with mm-hmm. Cuba and to make some progress there. So, if we have a change of leadership, is it likely that Cuban Americans who would be in a position to influence American policy would feel any differently about Cuba, about its government, and about mm-hmm. the pace of change that they would want to see? Would they feel any differently about it mm-hmm. if it was the one brother instead of the other?
Well, many won't. And many in positions of political influence are going to be inflexible, that either Castro brother is interchangeable, that both are monstrous. And in fact, you know, I really should say, I do describe in the book very, very ruthless, brutal, merciless activities by Raul Castro over the years, including a murder in Mexico City that I discovered he committed 50 years ago, a murder that went unreported and unsolved in Mexico for five decades. But getting back to Cuban-American attitudes, I think that the Cuban-American community is no longer a monolith. I lived in Miami for 7 months this year. I was a senior research associate at the University of Miami doing Cuba research there. And I'm not Cuban-American or Latin-American myself, but I got to know Cuban-Americans of just about every persuasion. And I was really taken with how the once monolithic Cuban community has fragmented and splintered. It could no longer be described as monolithic. And I know many there in Miami who would be very receptive to dealing with Raul Castro if he were to show the slightest signs of interest in a reciprocal process of, you know, aimed at normalizing relations.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, in fact, to what extent that breaks down along generational lines, that people who are younger, people who, say, were born in the United States of parents who were born in Cuba, or who are just too young to really have remembered Cuba, have a different attitude than, you know, their parents and grandparents might. And to them, the idea of going back and making over Cuba in the way it was, or mm-hmm. making it over to be something like South Florida is today, it's just not on their agenda.
Well, I think you're right on all those counts. The younger generation of Cubans, the largest number of them, are very different. They don't have the same fire in the belly, so to speak, about these issues. They're thoroughly American. Some of them don't even speak very fluent Spanish. It's changing. It's being diluted. Many Cuban Americans will go back after there's a free market democratic system that's established. But I think very few will go there to live. I think very few will transplant themselves back to the island. But many others will go back to invest, to help rebuild the country, to start small businesses, to rejoin families, maybe to have vacation homes. But I think a very, very small percentage will transplant themselves permanently back in Cuba.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Brian Littell. He's been a Latin America and Caribbean specialist for the last four decades, has worked in the CIA and also has been in the U.S. Air Force. So he's worked in the intelligence section of the government between 1990 and 94. In fact, he was National Intelligence Officer for Latin America, which is the highest ranking analytic position for that region in the U.S. intelligence community. He is now Senior Associate in the Americas Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington and is author of the recent book After Fidel, the Inside Story of Castro's Regime and Cuba's Next Leader. Palgrave Macmillan is the publisher. It is the story of the two Castro brothers, Fidel and Raul. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone in Danville, not too far away. Line number four. Hello.
Yes, Dave, is Danville. Mm-hmm. My simple question about economics in Cuba. Is there any chance that they would allow private ownership or leasing of sugarcane fields for the purpose of alcohol, that is, making ethanol alcohol for gasoline?
Well, you know, that's really a very interesting question. I think there's likely to be a really rich future for ethanol production in Cuba. I don't know about how much private enterprise on a small scale will be permitted, not in the near term, maybe in the longer term. But yes, you're right. Cuba was, for so many years, centuries really, the world's premier producer of sugar cane. And as we know, the Brazilians are producing ethanol very efficiently from sugar cane. So there's really nothing to prevent the Cubans from doing much the same thing and producing enough to export. So I think that that's a potential area of significant growth for Cuba.
All right. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455 if you have questions, comments. I think, actually, that maybe some people might be surprised at the extent of trade that's going on now between the United States and Cuba.
Absolutely. You're so right. It's not known by too many folks, but United States is probably now the fifth largest trading partner of Cuba. We're exporting agricultural goods in pretty large quantities and some medicines, but mostly agricultural goods. We may be the first or second largest exporter of agricultural commodities to Cuba. This, despite the embargo that everyone seems to be much more aware of. You know, another incongruity is that's not very well known is that. Here we don't have diplomatic relations with Cuba, yet we have the U.S. maintains the largest diplomatic mission in Havana. It's not an embassy, but it's the largest diplomatic mission. We do have direct dialogue with Cuba on some issues. The Cuban and American militaries have a regular monthly chat down at the fence line by Guantanamo, and It's a relationship that's really very complex.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that what people think about when they think about the United States and its policy toward Cuba is a longstanding, single-minded dedication to the idea of overthrowing the Cuban government and getting rid of Fidel Castro to the exclusion of anything else. And I think that now that While it is the case that may be something of an oversimplification, it is more complex. And yet, I think that an awful lot of people would make the argument that that policy just didn't make a whole lot of sense. It certainly doesn't now. Maybe it never did. And that if the goal of that policy was indeed the overthrow of the Cuban government, you'd have to say it has not been successful.
Well, you know, you're right. Of course, it was never sensible policy. The policy was at its peak in terms of hostility during the Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations. It was the Eisenhower administration who dreamed up the Bay of Pigs, and it was the Kennedy administration, of course, that implemented it. It was a terrible fiasco. But then the Kennedy administration was also very devoted for a couple of years to assassination plots against Castro and destabilization efforts. After the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, and after John Kennedy's assassination, just about all of that stopped, although the economic embargo, of course, has remained in place ever since. And the Cuban government considers it a, basically a hostile set of policies.
Well, you know, given that the fact that the relationship between Cuba and the United States was so much shaped by the Cold War, why was it that when the Cold War ended, it seemed that nothing changed?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because for years we did, American policy was based on the Cuban-Soviet alliance. After the disappearance of the Soviet Union, Cuba was added onto the list of international sponsors, state sponsors of terrorism. Actually, that was done in 1982, before the end of the Cold War. So that issue persisted. And then there were, of course, all of the human rights issues that are dear to Americans. The Cuban government has been a terrible, gross violator of human rights. Fidel has not allowed any room for any kind of independent or dissident speech or political or activity or organization. It is a very, very tough dictatorship. And just in recent years, Fidel imprisoned librarians and independent journalists and other human rights activists, all of whom are devoted to peaceful change. None of these are people who have advocated or become involved in violent change. The librarians are an interesting example. These are people who have small collections of books in their homes, and they lend them to neighbors. And they have been condemned as counter-revolutionaries because some of the books, like a biography of Martin Luther King, for example, some of those books are considered subversive by Castro's regime. I'm expecting a lot of that to begin softening now that Fidel is fading from the picture.
Let's talk with someone else up in northwestern Illinois in Rockford on our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question is this. Using just as a comparison the words of Dwight Eisenhower in his farewell speech of the military-industrial complex, what do you believe would be the biggest American companies that would move into the economy in Cuba, or names of American famous families?
Well, you know, that's a hard question. I don't think any American companies are going to go into Cuba, are going to risk investment until there is a democratic free market system with checks and balances and with guarantees. And they're probably not going to go in until all of the foreign claims by American companies that were expropriated, until all of those claims are settled. But that's going to happen. That's going to happen one of these days. So I'll try to answer your question with that, just with that preamble. I think American consumer good companies and retail firms will want to expand into Cuba. American construction companies and engineering firms will want to go into Cuba. They'll have tremendous opportunities, because the infrastructure on the island has broken down. There's been almost no investment, no improvement for now 50 years. So those kinds of American firms will have opportunities in Cuba. American agricultural producers will continue to have a large market in Cuba, as we've already said, and many others too. Energy companies. The Cubans now have discovered apparently fairly large reserves of deep underwater oil reserves down off their northwestern coast, sort of facing the Florida Keys. And American oil engineering firms at the right time may have the opportunity to become involved in Cuba. So those are just some of the things that come to mind, and lots of others, as well.
Okay.
I hope that answers your question.
Yes, right. It does. I wanted to ask you another one, but you said keep the call short.
So well, if you want to go ahead and ask another question, sure, go ahead.
Okay. You mentioned, or the announcer mentioned, that you were in the CIA.
That's right. I was.
Okay. I've got a very broad, definitive thinking mind. What American companies would go into Cuba coming in from another country under another name?
Well, a lot of big American corporations are multinationals, and I would think that many of them, either operating under their American corporate name or under an international name, would invest in Cuba.
Yeah, I was just looking for a name so that when I hear that name,
you want.
and not Japanese. I guess their economy went to the pits.
I think someday there'll be a lot of McDonald's restaurants all over Cuba. And you know, I think many of the big engineering firms, the names of which, you know, I'm not too familiar with the names of all of those, and I'm not in the business of giving out stock tips. But anyway, it's very long term. I don't think that this is going to happen in the next year or two.
So it's business as usual
for the next year or two. I think so, but with not completely as usual. I think we're going to see change. I think we're already beginning to see the first hints of change, because Fidel Castro is no longer calling all the shots.
I want to thank the caller and invite others. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. The toll-free line is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Our guest is Brian Littell. He's currently Senior Associate in the Americas Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He has been a Latin America and Caribbean specialist for the last 4 decades and continues to do a lot of speaking about the region from 1990 until 94. He was National Intelligence Officer for Latin America. That's the highest-ranking analytic position for that region in the U.S. intelligence community. He is author of the book After Fidel, The Inside Story of Castro's Regime and Cuba's Next Leader. It was published last October by Palgrave Macmillan. I'm sure you can continue to find it in the bookstore. Questions welcome. In fact, the phone lines have lit up. We have a number of people here we'll get to. Just let me ask you one quick question about the significance of Cuba and Fidel Castro for the rest of Latin America. And certainly recently we have seen a number of leaders elected in countries around Latin America, say beginning with Brazil, also including, of course, Venezuela and other places as well, governments that are on the left side of the political spectrum and for whom I think Mr. Castro and Cuba is a real touchstone.
Yeah.
In a symbolic sort of a sense, they seem to regard Mr. Castro as almost something of a living memorial, living monument. But having said that, what for some of these other leaders, what do you think is the significance of Cuba and Fidel Castro?
Well, he's a titanic figure, love him or hate him, and there are lots of people on both sides of that. He's the Latin American figure who in the last 100 years who has probably had the greatest impact in the hemisphere. He's really been remarkable, and so much of his appeal that continues in many quarters in Latin America derives from the fact that he has successfully for 47 years confronted and challenged the United States in ways that no other Latin American ever really has done. He defeated the Kennedy administration at the Bay of Pigs. We were humiliated as a country. He brought the world to the brink of nuclear disaster in 1962 during the missile crisis, and he continues to have strong backing, great appeal in Latin America. Chavez, the president of Venezuela, is a latter-day disciple of Fidel. Chavez models his governing style on Fidel's. And he was there at Fidel's bedside just about 10 days ago. He had traveled to Havana to be with Fidel. The president of newly elected president of Bolivia, Evo Morales, is another apparent disciple of Fidel's. So he still has an enormous appeal in Latin America all these years since the onset of the Cuban Revolution.
Well, when you use a phrase like someone is a disciple, does that mean that in the sense that they believe in independence for their country and that they don't want to be overly influenced by the United States, or does that mean a real commitment to the kind of political and economic system that Mr. Castro put in place in Cuba?
Right. Well, certainly, in the case of Chavez, it's certainly the first, and increasingly veering toward the second. Chavez now operates a government that's more and more authoritarian, although he was democratically elected on more than one occasion. He now operates and runs the country in a less and less democratic fashion. But he has not abolished the private sector as Fidel Castro did in 19, 1961. Chavez has not eliminated private corporations, private business. Venezuela is still one of our largest exporters of oil. Venezuela owns Citgo. It's one of the large oil companies here in the United States. It's a Venezuelan state company. So, Chavez has not gone as far as Fidel, and frankly, I doubt that he will.
Well, let's go back and talk with some people who are listening. Atlanta, Illinois is next. This is line number one. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. I've got a question for you. I'll tell you how I came about the question was about 4 years ago on this very program, there was a scientist that went down to Cuba, mainly interested in their agricultural side of things, and he came back with some amazing finds that after Russia had left Cuba. Cuba was in dire straits as far as agriculture and the fact that they didn't have any money anymore. So they developed their own agriculture, which was mainly organic because they didn't have the resources to do heavy fertilization and chemicals and stuff that we do here. And his report was that in Cuba, when he was there about 4 years ago, according to this program, there was no hungry people in Cuba. And then 2 years ago, the National Geographic magazine published a map of the world, the state of the world, they called the map, and the only positive thing on that whole map was that there was thousands of gardens in Havana providing tons and tons of food to the population. So my question is, do you think that if we get more normal relations with Cuba, that maybe we've got something to learn also?
Well, you're right about the organic element of their agriculture. I don't know that it's very voluntary because Cuba has become an ecological disaster area in almost all other respects. But you're right; they haven't had the hard currency to buy a lot of fertilizer, herbicides, pesticides, and so forth. It's had its pluses and minuses. The pluses you've described, I think, pretty well. But keep in mind that Cuba still imports the overwhelming portion of its agricultural needs. They're importing a very large percentage of it from the United States. And the other thing to keep in mind is that the sugar industry, which historically was the backbone of the Cuban economy, the backbone of Cuban agriculture, that the sugar sector has collapsed in recent years. They have been forced to close down the majority of their sugar mills. And sugar production is down now to historically low levels, levels down to down to where it was 100 or 150 years ago. And one of the main reasons is because they can't afford mechanization, and they can't afford the necessary herbicides, pesticides, and fertilizers and so forth. So there have been pluses and minuses, but in sugar it's been a disaster.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, let's go to next, Urbana. This is line number two.
I kind of wanted to draw out the economic direction that Cuba may end up in once either Raul is in power or they have a new government, in place. What do you think the chances that Cuba will become another beachfront property, another, tourist trap that really the people who live on the island do nothing to service that economy?
Mm-hmm. To a large extent, that's already happening. Fidel was opposed, as you know, to allowing large numbers of tourists on the island for those reasons. But in the mid-1990s, 93, 94, when the Cuban economy was literally just at the verge of total collapse, and maybe even social upheaval, this was after the Soviet Union disappeared and all of the subsidies ended, Fidel decided in 93, 94 to allow large numbers of tourists to come, and there has been Spanish and Canadian and Mexican investment, other countries too, in tourist hotels and tourist facilities. But and they bring in a good deal of hard currency that way. But the tourism is described by many as tourism apartheid, the South African word for separation of groups, and it's called tourism apartheid because Cuban citizens are generally not allowed to go to the tourist hotels or the tourist restaurants. They can't take advantage of the tourist facilities, even if they have the hard currency that you have to have, to stay at those kinds of places. But I think that in the future, I think this will be changing. I think that as Fidel Castro's regime now fades away and Raul and others, other successors, will be taking charge, I think all of that is going to change. I don't mean in the next 6 months or the next year, but I'm optimistic that that the apartheid element of the tourism will end and that more and more tourists will from the United States will be allowed to go.
Okay, thanks.
All right, we're moving into our last 15 minutes, and again, I have a number of callers. Callers will help us by trying to be brief. That way we can get in as many as possible. Our guest, Brian Littell, he is Senior Associate in the Americas Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. He is author of the book, After Fidel, The Inside Story of Castro's Regime and Cuba's Next Leader, published last October by Palgrave Macmillan. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next up is a person on a cell phone here, line number 3. Hello.
Yeah, hi, good morning. My question was, if Raul forced to choose between political reform or economic reform, which one do you think he would choose, and which one do you think would sort of lead to the government there lasting a longer period of time? In other words, if Raul had to choose personal political freedoms over liberalization and private.
Well, I think the signals are pretty clear. He's attracted to the China model, and what that means, I guess, is that he's not going to allow any greater political participation, freedom, speech, organization, no opposition political parties, just like China. But he's also attracted to the economic part of the China model, decentralizing the economy, especially at the grassroots level. Maybe allowing more foreign investment on easier terms, and encouraging low-level entrepreneurship among the Cuban people. I don't think he wants to have a whole lot of Cuban millionaires emerging in the short term. I don't think he's going to go that far. But decentralizing the economy is something that I think he's made it pretty clear already that that's what he wants to do. You know, one interesting point, Raul Castro, unlike Fidel, has spoken on more than one occasion very favorably about the virtues of supply and demand. Those are not words that ever come out of Fidel's mouth, but they do out of Raul's mouth. Supply and demand.
Do you think there are any other Latin American countries that could prevail on him to sort of open up the political reforms more than economic ones? And I'll take my answer off here. Thanks.
Well, I think it's going to be slower. Political reform will come. Democracy will come to Cuba. A free market democratic system is inevitable, I think. I just can't say when. The economic opening that I think is coming will inevitably cause more and more pressures, increasing pressures, for political opening as well. And I don't think that Cuba under Raul or under successors of Raul will be able to hold out as long as the Chinese have in refusing political reform. There are just so many other factors that will militate against against them being able to do that. One of the factors that I mentioned is the youth cohort, all of the 2.5 million restless young Cubans who want greater opportunity. And the other variable is the Cuban diaspora that has a lot of influence still, direct and indirect.
All right, let's go to Champaign County here, line 1. Hello.
Hi. You're talking to a state where major political figure like Ryan and people from ADM already went to Cuba to talk about trade. So the idea that Raul has to come in before the Cubans will probe changing in the relationship seems to me kind of specious. It seems that we have to start analyzing what this country, the blocks inside of this country are rather than the ones inside of Cuba. One of the disaffections that I've been hearing about in Cuba is the fact that they're exporting too many doctors. They've sent a lot in trade deals to Venezuela and other places, but they've also shown up the U.S. The U.S. sent something like two mobile hospitals and some unit of doctors to Pakistan after the horrific earthquake. The Cubans sent something like 100 mobile clinics and myriad of doctors, including women doctors, who could treat the injured women in Pakistan
mm-hmm.
without the So I just think that when the disaffection is a lack of health care because not because we have here, because they're doing things like suppressing people going to med school and more people going into cosmetic surgery than basic, when that's the reason we have our shortage of health care here, when it's because they're sending them overseas in humanitarian and other ventures
mm-hmm.
to Central America, that's an interesting disaffection, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm going to do this because I really suggest that we have someone else other to talk about this issue. I'm sure, David, you're thinking about that, and I would suggest Saul Landau, who's done a couple of films about Fidel in Cuba more generally, is associated with people that know a lot about the green movement there as well. I just Googled you and found out there are accusations that you were the one working to destabilize Haiti, and that you're
no, that's nonsense.
Yeah, well, you were the point person on Haiti.
You know the
Tonton Constant, right? Because
no, I don't know that person. I don't know,
yeah.
David. I know you asked me to be on this program because I'm respected as a an unbiased, objective analyst and observer, and I hope your audience won't be distracted by this caller's charges, which are groundless.
Well, and
I hope that you know the best evidence is in my book. I would encourage your audience to get a copy of my book, and see if they consider it to be biased or extreme.
Well, and I hope the caller will forgive me for wanting to go on, because we're getting short on time and I have some other callers. Someone in the nearby community of Belgium, they're next. This is line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. I try to be as quick as possible. You mentioned earlier that the Miami contingents of the people who are involved from Cuba, the Cuban people who have left, seem to have a lot of desire to create problems for what was taken away from them in Cuba. Aren't they the ones that seem to push strongest for this embargo we have? And then on top of that, the interesting power they have in our own political system here in the recent past. And I'll listen off air. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, Cuban Americans, you're right, have a great deal of influence in the American political system. They have Cuban Americans have become citizens overwhelmingly. They vote in very large percentages. They take advantage of all of the opportunities that our system has offered. There's one Cuban American senator in Washington who's a Democrat, and there's another Cuban American senator in Washington who's a Republican. There are 3 Cuban Americans in the House of Representatives. They're Republicans, but a fourth may very well be elected in November from New Jersey, who will be a Democrat. It's not as highly partisan as a lot of people think. As I said earlier, the Cuban American community is no longer the monolith that a lot of people like to think of it. You know, there's a city in South Florida. It's the fifth largest city in the state, and it's been dominated by Democrat politicians. For more than 20 years. It's the city of Hialeah. So Cuban Americans are really very complicated in their outlooks and their politics, but they're very engaged in our politics. There's no question about that, and they have a lot of influence.
All right, let's talk with someone in Urbana. This is next caller. It's line 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for taking my call. I was in Marine Corps Intelligence, and I was in Cuba during the missile crisis. As a matter of fact, it happened halfway through my 18-month tour down there. And one of the things that you mentioned that I have a question about is that you said that monthly they have the military meets at, I suppose, the Northwest Gate, the Cuban and the American military. I just wonder what level, because when I was down there, they'd met just about every day. You know, have you ever been there?
I've never been to Guantanamo.
Well, there's a yellow line halfway between the 2 gatehouses,
mm-hmm.
and they'd go out there. A lot of the Marines that I knew had been friends of the government of Cuba troops that overthrew Batista. At the time, they thought it was a good idea,
mm-hmm.
you know. But at any rate...
These are pretty high-level talks now. They've been going on for, I don't know, the last 5 or 6 years, maybe a little bit longer. And it's a Cuban general. I think it's now an admiral. It used to be a Cuban general, army general, and I think it's now an admiral who meets with the monthly with the base commander. I guess the base commander, our base commander, is a Navy captain.
Yeah.
So it's fairly high level.
Mm-hmm. When I was down there, it was an admiral. It was the base commander.
Uh-huh.
I have one historically that you might be interested in. As you probably know, the Cubanos at that time were they didn't have much respect for Kennedy. The Cuban Missile Crisis, the way that it came about,
mm-hmm.
well, not the way it came about, but the political spin they put on it, they were really suspicious about how, you know, they said they found out about this, and then right away they had these high-level meetings one weekend. Well, there were some pretty remarkable coincidences. One is we had a command post exercise every 6 weeks, which meant we were mobilized. That happened to be the weekend. But even more of a remarkable coincidence, was the fact that, of course, they wanted to get all the non-combat people, all the civilians off the base,
mm-hmm.
and they couldn't fly them out. They simply didn't have, there wasn't the capacity.
Mm-hmm.
There were two troop ships that made semi-monthly trips between Brooklyn and Trinidad to transfer people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be darned if both of those ships, one of them would be there 1 month, the other one the other month. It takes a while to make that circuit. Would you believe that very weekend they were both docked at Guantanamo,
mm-hmm.
and they could both, of course, they could get everybody off of there.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just a political thing, but the timing seemed to be, you know, we're coming up to October, we had some off-year elections, it didn't hurt, you know, Kennedy was able to look very presidential that
mm-hmm.
weekend. Anyway, that's my somewhat cynical comment.
Well, John Kennedy is still a controversial president in the eyes of many Cuban Americans, but there was also the Bay of Pigs, of course.
We have just a couple minutes left. You know, we were talking at the beginning of the program about the fact that for a long time now, I think that the expectation was, as we said, that if Fidel Castro could no longer be president for whatever reason, his brother would become president. And that your suggestion is that no matter what happens now, it seems that, you know, Fidel Castro is 80 years old and he's had this serious illness, I think a lot of people expect that he's not going to return to his duties as he had done them before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very likely that at some point here, the temporary handover is going to become permanent. Though, having said all that, Raul Castro is 75 years old. He's
That's
not
right.
a young man either.
Right.
He won't be there forever either. Is there what sort of speculation is there, or perhaps better than speculation, about the next
Mm-hmm.
leader after that?
Yeah, exactly. That's really a key question. And it's one of the key responsibilities that Raul Castro is going to have now that's being thrust on him. Historically, the Castro brothers have never permitted a third man. They've never had anybody next in line of succession behind them because they've always thought that such a person would be a threat or a potential threat to them. But now that Fidel is fading and Raul is taking over, he is going to have to take care of that. And the person that I think he may choose is a current vice president and an economic czar. His name is Carlos Laje, and I have a hunch that Raul may name Carlos Laje to be the president of the country. Raul would do it through all of the appropriate institutions. But then if Laje becomes the president of Cuba and Raul is governing, calling a lot of the shots from the background, which is the way he's always preferred to do it anyway, then Cuba would have a successor figure and the beginnings of a successor regime that would come after Raul.
Hmm.
And this Laje is a moderate. He's considered an economic reformer. So it would represent significant change.
And so, you would not expect, at the point where Fidel Castro passes, you would not expect any real extraordinary kind of reaction to that? Nothing revolutionary, as one would say.
Well, you know, the experience of the record of the last 30 days, 28, 29 days, is suggesting that there will not be disturbances when the word is released that Fidel has died. The Cuban people have accepted the succession very peacefully. So maybe that's what will hold. Now, longer term, it's very hard to predict. Raul is 75. He's a heavy drinker. He's certainly had some health problems in the past himself, although that's also a secret. The mid and longer term future is very hard to discern.
Well, there we will have to leave it. If people are interested in reading more about Cuba and particularly about the two brothers, Fidel and Raul Castro, you can look for the book that was just published last fall, After Fidel, The Inside Story of Castro's Regime and Cuba's Next Leader, published by Palgrave Macmillan. I'm sure you can still find it in the bookstore, by our guest Brian Littell. He is currently senior associate in the Americas program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. And Mr. Littell, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.